Bet the board.
What do you mean you don't bet?
I mean, I don't bet. You know, I don't
gamble.
I don't. I never have, and I never will.
Yeah, right.
I'll bet you $20 I can get you gambling before the end of the day.
You owe me $15,000, pal.
Pay him. Pay that man his money.
It's the Bet the Board podcast.
God likes me. He really, really likes me.
In the end, I wound up right back where I started. I could still pick winners, and I could still make money for all kinds of people back home. And why mess up a good thing?
Here's Payne Insider and Todd Furman.
Welcome into the Bet the Board podcast, NFL Week 1 Monday Night Football edition. I'm your host, Todd Furman, joined as always by my esteemed colleague and co-host, the one, the only Payne Insider.
I'm surprised you were able to join us this morning. Heard you had a wild weekend, a little Tom Cruise Risky Business Part 2 action for you. You were home alone.
If by wild weekend you mean not leaving the house yesterday until I went out for dinner of halftime of the Steelers-Patriots game, then apparently that's what wild means when you get into your late 30s, Payne. A little bit anticlimactic compared to how I used to spend my weekends when I moved to Vegas.
What'd you get?
Tested out a new little Greek establishment, but a little chicken shawarma salad with a side of falafel. My stomach wasn't exactly the best this morning, so it might be why the podcast gets out a little bit later.
Ah, gotcha. TMI. What are we doing today?
I think we're going to talk about two Monday Night Football games. We're going to discuss what we saw yesterday from Week 1 that really stood out, and the good, bad, and the ugly. Look ahead lines. And, of course, your injury update with some impactful fantasy notes from the unparalleled Dr. David Chow. Sounds like a game plan?
Beautiful. Now, two things. One, we appreciate everyone joining our Bet the Board contest.
Record-setting year for the Bet the Board podcast. Rough Monday already.
Yes, you're struggling. I'm going to help you. Oh, 3,800 entries. That was a record for us. So congratulations to everyone that has joined. Fantastic. The other thing is I lost my mind. We were supposed to have an iTunes winner announced last Thursday. Completely forgot. The winner is Z Timko. So he is the iTunes winner. And again, we'll run another one of these on the Thursday podcast in Week 4. It's very simple. Just go to iTunes, give the podcast 5 stars, and leave a nice little sentence or two, and you're automatically entered to win a Bet the Board swag pack. It's a Visa gift card. It's some t-shirts and things of that nature. So Z_Timko is the winner for Week 1. Just email us, bettheboardpodcast@gmail.com, with all your information, and we'll get your swag pack out to you.
Not a bad little way to start your Monday morning, so enjoy all that, Z Timko. And for all listeners, like Payne said, record-setting year, we appreciate all of you guys signing up, and we know the competition is only going to get fiercer as the season progresses. Payne, good, the bad, and the ugly, and I want to open it up to you, but I want to be glass-half-full guy to start things off today. So what surprised you in a positive manner for what you saw so far through Week 1?
Lamar, baby. Let's go. I was hoping Harbaugh let him try for the record. It was like 7 passing TDs and he yanked him with like a quarter and a half to go. So I would have liked to have seen him try to achieve 7 touchdowns, run it up, kind of stick it in everyone's back who said Lamar couldn't throw. And listen, like if you go back to the AFC preview podcast, you can do that. We've timestamped it. Every team is there, including Baltimore. And the two things we mentioned a month ago was the growth of Lamar as a passer, and I think the style in receiver in which Baltimore went out and got this offseason, and it wasn't that sure-handed route runner. They got burners to create more space, and Hollywood Brown was dynamic, led the week in Week 1 yards after catch above expectation. So fantastic there. All the things came to fruition. Now, I get it, 60 minute sample size against possibly the worst team in the league, but I think you have to like the possibilities from what we saw from Baltimore's offense. Now it's on Greg Roman and Harbaugh to kind of continually add new wrinkles to this offense each week.
Before we look at overall team performance, does any other individuals really stand out for you when you were watching games yesterday?
I like Sammy Watkins. You know, when he's healthy, absolute freak. That opening touchdown, if you watch, and I know you were watching that game, ridiculously hard cut at full speed. He appears healthy. The feet look healthy. Everything that I had heard coming into the season was Patty and Sammy kind of worked out a ton this offseason together because there was that potential that Tariq Hill would be suspended. Now Hill's out for a good stretch. We'll find out more about that injury when we talk to Dr. Chow here in a little bit. But everyone close to the team kind of saw the chemistry between Mahomes and Watkins really start to finally take shape in OTAs. You look at Watkins, he had 54% of the Chiefs' air yards yesterday. When you look at yards after catch, Watkins averaged 9 more per catch than expectation. So Sammy was the guy that we saw early in his Buffalo career yesterday.
9 catches, 198 yards on 11 targets. So a hell of a performance there. One thing in that campaign, and I'm not sure if you watched that game in its entirety, I begrudgingly sat there and watched the entire first half as Jacksonville attempted to tackle air, sitting on a ticket for the Jaguars. Jacksonville loses Nick Foles, and we're going to get Dr. Chow's take on exactly what that means for how long a timeline we're looking at with a broken collarbone. Gardner Minshew steps in, goes 22-25 in his NFL debut, 275 yards, 2 touchdowns, DJ Shark, 4 catches, 146. And the Jags average 8.6 yards per play. I don't even know what to make of what we saw from Jacksonville. Is that more the byproduct of the Chiefs' defense, or do we think Jacksonville is going to try to throw the ball a little bit more this season with the young quarterback?
In general, I know the Jaguars wanted to throw the ball a little bit more this season, right? That's why you bring in DeFilippo, you sign Nick Foles to that big contract. Verdict's still out, obviously. But it's going to be mustache mania there in Jacksonville with Gardner Minshew for probably the next month or so at least. And when I looked at Minshew, he completed 56% of his passes in the preseason, only averaged 4.8 yards per pass attempt against a lot of guys that are no longer in this league. So the one thing I'm doing, as soon as we get done recording today, I'm going to go back, watch the All-22. I just want to see how the Chiefs defended him, right? Was it a bunch of soft zone because the score was, you know, I believe it was 30-13 and then 37-13 in the third and fourth quarter? How soft were the Chiefs in coverage at that point? We knew, right, Minshew was praised for his accuracy by Mike Leach, but a lot of people questioned the arm strength. So I just want to see what it looks like, how the Chiefs defended him late in that game. It was kind of out of reach. I think it's obviously different when defenses are going to be able to game plan specifically for him. Probably going to be a lot of tighter defenses. So I just want to take a gander at what unfolded there before I kind of have a really hard opinion on Gardner Minshew.
You've definitely seen the market react again that we'll talk about briefly in some of our look ahead lines. And Payton, we've gone almost 7 minutes on the podcast today with no mention of Antonio Brown signing with the New England Patriots. So we may as well go there. We delayed the inevitable. New England, of course, 6.9 yards per play in their win against the Steelers, 7-14 on third down. Tom Brady, 300 plus performance, 3 touchdown passes, second best performance for a quarterback his age as far as productivity there. So they spread the ball around for a wealth of riches. But what does AB give New England if he keeps his head on straight?
I don't know, because it's going to be that ridiculous, right? I mean, this offense is going to be just, it's tough to put into words, right? I mean, I think last night we just saw there was this motivated effort for Brady. And if the Patriots and everyone stays healthy, this version of New England is far more talented, far deeper, more versatile than the Patriots team that just won the Super Bowl back in February. And I think last night's a perfect example of this. You look and it's like, oh man, Brady starts the game 1-for-4. And that first throw to Edelman is just this wobbling duck 5 yards short. And you're like, there he is, 43 years old. This could be trouble. Let's monitor this. And from that point on, you know, Brady completes 72% of his passes the rest of the way, had 10 explosive passes. And, the one thing that we kind of touched on, if you go back to Thursday's podcast, was Sean Davis, the safety that was going to be out for the Steelers. And his replacement was Cam Kelly. He was an AFF player. And when the game is 20-3, after Mike Tomlin cowardly and brainlessly kicks a field goal down 20 from the 1 yard line, the very next possession, the game ends because Brady picks on Cam Kelly and Dorsett goes for the 58 yarder. So offense is going to be really scary with Josh Gordon and Antonio Brown. If they can get every aspect of their lives figured out, I would think, you know, Tom Brady's already come out and welcomed AB into his home, said, hey, you can stay with me while you get your stuff figured out, build that chemistry, just kind of work on things. Now, the one thing, there's the conspiracy theorists out there that said this was long planned. A lot of the latter antics from AB towards the end of the Raiders situation were done on purpose, because it was crazy to see how the Patriots signed, got a deal done 30 minutes after you could start negotiating with him. There was people that were like, oh, this has been in the works for weeks now. We know the Patriots wanted him last year. The Pittsburgh Steelers would not trade him to the Patriots. So they got their guy. This is going to be dynamic when you can think about Josh Gordon, A.B., Edelman in the slot. You just have a slew of pass catchers. Last night, Burkhead getting a lot of work. It makes sense, right? In a blowout like that, get Burkhead some touches. Save some of the wear and tear on your other backs like White. So this offense is going to be elite.
Well, I can tell you one thing. It makes handicapping a full NFL card that much easier, because I'm not going to spend a ton of time breaking down Patriots games trying to make a case to bet against them. on a regular basis. So I'm curious to see how ridiculous the numbers get. Of course, we're going to see them as 2 touchdown plus favorites as early as this weekend on the road against the Miami Dolphins. With the good pain, of course, comes the bad. And what were the standout performances of the negative variety?
You know, I think you have to look at Cleveland. You know, that's rough situation there. We kind of saw it coming a little bit, although I got to tell you, didn't play the Titans because the number was right in line with where I made it. But now you got Baker Mayfield, bruised wrist on his throwing hand. Yeah, the word is that it happened during the Cam Wake sack on the safety. Throws 3 picks after that. Tom Withers, a Cleveland beat writer, said Mayfield kept his right arm kind of tucked close by his side and hidden during the postgame presser. We'll see. Hopefully we get some word on that and more clarity from Dr. Chow. Cleveland goes right out of the gates, right, and gets that touchdown. I think everyone's thinking, oh, off to the races. This is exactly what we envisioned. But it was kind of junk after that. I went back, watched part of the game as it was happening live, more of it last night on the All-22. There's just a lack of execution, lack of discipline. And the one area, I think, where we really hammered home that there was a severe question mark about the Browns' offense was their offensive line. And so when you have 182 yards in penalties, it's 2 football fields worth. You're going to be playing from behind the chains a lot, right? And it's going to be these known passing situations. Your O-line already is a weakness, but that kind of gets exacerbated a little bit when opposing defenses know you're forced to pass. D-linemen don't have a threat of run. And so, you know, Titans DC Dan Pease sent a ton of nickel blitzes, sent a ton of pressure yesterday, and the Cleveland Browns offensive line couldn't handle it.
Yeah, not exactly a great start for the Brownies. And you mentioned those penalties. 18 for 182, the final tally. Nice. You throw in the turnovers. Not exactly a recipe to win, let alone cover as a favorite of nearly a touchdown. So the Browns' futility in that regard already starting up here in 2019. As far as other bad performances for me, Payne, I watch the Seattle Seahawks. I know they come away with a 21-20 victory. But in that game against the Bengals, they're outgained 429 to 233. Yards per play, 6.1 to 4.8. Passing yardage outgained by Andy Dalton and company, 395 to 161. Naturally, the Seahawks end up on the right side of turnover luck. And like they always seem to do, find a way to win a tight, tight ballgame.
Yeah, to your point, and on the reverse, I thought Cincinnati was outstanding. You know, you go into that tough environment, you outgain Seattle by nearly 200 yards. Andy Dalton was on fire. He was sacked 5 times, but he was standing in the pocket, delivering throws. If it wasn't for the 3 lost fumbles, Cincinnati wins that game outright convincingly as a 9.5-point dog. Joe Mixon injury, we'll see how serious that is. The one interesting part to me was Zach Taylor and company looked organized. They had a game plan. That was the one question from a lot of pro bettors were, what is this guy, right? He was like unemployed 2 years ago. He was like, you know, McVay brings him on as a wide receiver coach. This has the potential to go just horrifically there and with a guy over his head. But so far, again, 60-minute sample size, let's not overreact. But it was a good opening debut for Zach Taylor and that coaching staff.
As far as the ugly is concerned, do you want to rant now, or, you know, how much you want to get off your chest regarding Adam Vinatieri's performance kicking the football? Thankfully, T.Y. Hilton became a man to the rescue, bailing out our Colts ticket.
Listen, I kind of joked around with you on text. I said, how large of an edge do the gambling gods think we have on these games? Because
they don't make it easy. I'll tell you that much. They don't make it easy on us.
We made the game 5.8. So we took 7 on the Colts. And, you know, for the listeners out there, that's literally the edge we have when we're investing here, right? It's like 1.2 points around a key. It makes it even more valuable. But Adam Vinatieri, arguably the biggest, the best, the kicker ever, goes out, blows two field goals, and they point after. It's 7 points out the window. And it's not just him, right? The second drive of the game for the Chargers, the Colts get this massive stop. They hold the 3 points, and then they rough a kicker on a 22-yard attempt. Like, it's a 22-yarder. You're probably not going to have an opportunity to block that. They rough the kicker. Chargers offense comes back out, scores a touchdown, tack on another 4 points. The Colts literally gave away 11 points yesterday. Could have won the game outright. Still a decent Colts team, as everyone knows. It's how much we think about the coaching staff and the talent. But right now, like the margin for error is evaporated, obviously, when Luck retired. You can't give away 11 points.
Well, there was another instance in that game as well. Third and long at 3rd and 9. The Colts appear to get a stop. Ends up that they had jumped off sides. And the next play, Austin Ekeler goes for 60 yards in one of his 2 touchdown yep. catches. So you talk about so many things that had to go against the Colts. But God bless Malik Hooker for the one-handed interception, which gave us a chance to march down the length of the field and get the cover there.
What a play,
with them going down by 6 points. Incredible. I mean, but to be able to put your giant paw out there and haul that thing in, simply incredible. The last thing, Payne, before we go on to some of the look-ahead numbers, quick thoughts on what you saw Thursday night or didn't see from the Packers and Bears. I know people said, hey, we're Debbie Downer. We talked about the Bears as a sell. The Bears actually outgained the Packers, 254 to 213. Both teams go for less than 4 yards per play. 5 of 27 they combined for as far as third down conversions.
Yeah, that game literally put me to sleep on the couch, like in real time. No joke about it. Had to go back and watch
normally
it later.
Normally you reserve that for college football on Saturdays.
Yeah, especially when they end at like 5 a.m. Eastern with that Washington.
You were asleep for Cal 7 debacle. Hours before.
Listen, I when I watched the game, I thought Matt Nagy was trying to be too cute. It's like he was trying to show the world how great he was on national TV. Mitch Trubisky was horrific. The Packers defense, which we thought would be improved, was. The Packers offense, though, and I know there's a couple people playing Friday morning quarterback rather than Monday morning quarterback talking about how easy the Packers victory was. But I got to tell you, 3.7 yards per play for the Packers. If you told any better in the world that, hey, this offense is going to average 3.7 yards per play, you're on the road, you're going to lose that game by double digits. And if you remove the one singular good drive in the second quarter of 74 yards, Packers offense averaged 2.3 yards per play. So we knew going in, Green Bay was implementing a new system. A lot of the starters hadn't really worked together with, you know, when live bullets were there. And it showed. Ugly game all around. Not going to take too much from it. Both these teams now have extended time, a little bit extended rest in preparation with that Thursday night game. Let's see what it looks like moving forward.
Yeah, the Bears, a big game on the road at Denver.
I'm going to set you up for this, by the way. Before we move on, what did you think of Adam Gase and that Jets offense? I know you got a couple Jets buddies listening to the show.
I don't know if there are strong enough words. I got a laundry list of texts. Now, full disclosure here, one of our loyal listeners and one of my buddies from college is a big-time Jets fan. Did bet the Bills in that game. Said he was thrilled with the way that the thing unfolded late in the contest. But a couple of the other guys went, they had no idea how to wrap their head around what that was offensively. Now, the lone bright spot there, Jamison Crowder apparently is going to be a beast catching four-yard passes as a possession receiver, the way that offense looks. Le'Veon Bell showed flashes, but the offensive line, major concerns there. And the fact that Jets even had a chance to win that football game, simply mind-boggling. And if it wasn't for the C.J. Mosley injury keeping him off the field late in the game, they probably do win that contest.
Yeah, if you're not just scoreboard watching and you're really digging into these games, the Jets stunk. Buffalo wins that game by double digits if it's not for the 4 turnovers in the first half. 8 points scored by the Jets defense. And Adam Gase's offense, a lot of the dink and dunk. It's a perfect marriage with him and Jamison Crowder, as you alluded to. He's going to have probably about 16 catches a game for 3.5 yards a pop. And that's what Adam Gase's offense averaged, 3.4 yards per play. Still 4 teams left to play this week, but safe to say, although we haven't seen Oakland or Denver's offense operate, but safe to say, I think at this point, 3.4 yards per play for the Jets offense will go down as the worst of week one.
Yeah, it'll make for a massive game a week from today when the Jets play host to the Cleveland Browns, 2 teams that optimism reigns supreme for both. Obviously, one of them is going to emerge after 2 weeks with an 0-2 record. We'll, of course, preview that game in greater detail. Some look-ahead lines, Payne. As we know, overreaction is always the order of the day, even for odds makers who are forced to adjust. based on one data point. So we'll kind of go a little rapid fire on some of these. Thursday night's game, which of course you'll get an extended preview right here on the typical Thursday Bet the Board podcast edition. Carolina on the look ahead number was a 4.5 point favorite. That number goes out to 6.5 on the heels of a 30-27 loss against the Rams. But I think that has a lot more to do with Jameis Winston, who apparently hasn't figured out you're supposed to throw the football to players wearing your same color jersey.
Tough to watch. You know, before week one, I was looking at our core number, no factors or elements added. We had a 5.1 on this game. And obviously, as our listeners know, we went over their win total. We certainly liked the prospects of them in week one a little bit. And so we're higher on the Panthers than I think the rest of the market. So we were at 5.1 before the 4.5 number on the look ahead. And I think you just look at the Panthers, right? They blew a ton of opportunities early against the Rams. They had a fumble on the opening possession near the green zone. Your third possession, I believe they got down to the Rams 29-yard line, came away with 0 points. The fourth possession, I know some of the guys over there internally were heated because Cam gets credited with the fumble for the backwards pass. If you watch the film closer, ball's actually tipped. Should have been an incomplete pass. So I think the Panthers showed a little bit better than the final score indicated as well. And I think, you know, you have the history of how hard it is on a short week for Thursday for road teams. Now, I think that's interesting, right? If we get to 7, what does it look like at that key number? In week 2, I would think the short week isn't as big of a deal when you're looking at and comparing it to maybe like, you know, down the line in week 13. But you mentioned Jameis Winston. Ugly. Now, you want to chalk this up and not overreact because it's a 60-minute sample size. And the other thing that Tampa was dealing with was the flu. Right. Flu bug hit the Bucs locker room, really prevented a lot of sharp bettors who were looking that way to actually end up investing because that flu bug hit. Mike Evans was one of the guys impacted. He looked like a zombie out there. So something to monitor over the next couple days as well.
All about hydration, getting yourself ready, especially on a short turnaround for a big divisional game, as both those teams will look to avoid 0-2 starts. Modest move here, but onto a key number for both these games, so wanted to hit him relatively quick. The Titans and Chargers, both 2.5 point favorites in look-ahead spots. The Titans at home to the Colts. We know with Andrew Luck at the helm, the Colts never lost the Titans. That number now out to a field goal. And Payne, the Chargers were 2.5 point favorites on the look-ahead. They go on the road to Detroit and now find themselves a full field goal favorite.
Chargers were a really good road team last year, and it's not overly difficult to figure out why. But market currently like 2.9. Interesting to see how the Lions respond. That was like a heartbreaking tie. Detroit had no business not winning that game. Matthew Stafford, I thought, played a pretty good game despite the lack of competition from Arizona's defense there. But the one thing that's interesting, and let's see this play out, Stafford kind of blows a gasket there on the sidelines after the new OC Daryl Bevel calls timeout on a play where Detroit literally picked up a first down. So Lions, you know, have to then rerun this play. They get stuffed and are forced to punt. Stafford runs to the sideline, slams down his helmet, and is like yelling, "Trust me, trust me." So Stafford didn't believe Daryl Bevel had the confidence in him checking into the right play. Going to be an interesting dynamic to monitor there moving forward.
When we look at the Giants and Bills, a 4-point move here across the zero. The Giants on the wrong side of a lopsided decision against the Dallas Cowboys. Dak Prescott, a very nice performance, 400-plus yards passing. So good for the Cowboys, saying they were going to ease Ezekiel Elliott into the offense with 20 to 25 touches. Bills going right back to the scene of the crime where they came back against the Jets. Now 2 to 2.5 point road favorites, where on a look-ahead number they were 1.5 point pups.
Yeah, really interesting. Obviously, Buffalo played significantly better than the scoreboard resulted. The Giants struggled, and I think a lot of that obviously to do with how good the Dallas Cowboys are, a team that we're really high on. Loved what I saw from Kellen Moore. So I'm just not sure how the Giants offense is going to hold up here. It's going to be a tough matchup because you figure the Bills are going to remove Saquon Barkley from the fold, and it's all on Eli at that point, and that's a scary proposition. So I'd be interested to see if this gets to the key of 3.
New England, not much to say here. Just wanted to bring it up. 11-point favorites on a look-ahead number, now out to 16-point chalk against the Miami Dolphins. Apparently, bettors are going to need iron stomachs to back the home dog here, coming off a 40-point debacle at the hand of the Ravens.
Yeah, not shocking when you see how the Dolphins looked, the biggest blowout of the week, and then you get the Patriots dominating on national TV for a Sunday night football game. And then just this morning, Dolphins players come out, and I shouldn't say come out. This probably isn't overly public yet, but a couple of the Dolphins players have requested from their agents to search for a trade. But in general, right, I don't know how high this goes. This, you know, at 15, probably not a number I'm willing to dabble in. It'll be interesting to see if it gets to 17. But in general, I would think, and I kind of know, Belichick and Brady wouldn't want to run it up on the guys over here in Miami, a lot of guys that they're buddy-buddy with. But the Dolphins are just so bad right now. Even if New England goes in there with what I would expect to be some vanilla offensive concepts, some vanilla defense, 11 was probably a little short, but it'll be interesting to see where this line goes moving throughout the week.
And this game, we haven't even seen one of these two teams play, but you see how the market reacts to a change at quarterback. The Houston Texans, 3-point favorites against the Jacksonville Jaguars on a look at number. We'll call it anywhere in the dead zone from 8.5 to 9, 9.5. I was a little bit surprised here because I don't think it's a full touchdown drop off to Gardner Minshew, but I guess odds makers felt the need. They had to react based on a change of quarterback, even not having seen a sample size for the Houston Texans yet.
Yeah, spot on. So the move is predicated on the downgrade from Foles to Minshew. Texans haven't played yet. It'll be interesting to see what this line could do if the Texans somehow win that game outright. I just think when I look at this, I want to see what Minshew really looked like. We'll find out here probably after we record this podcast. But you mentioned this. It's 6.5 points numerically. But obviously, value-wise, the market is saying it's more than a 6.5-point move because you factor in coming off the 3, going through the 4, 6, and 7, all numbers not created equal in the NFL market.
Well, if we're going to talk about injuries and how they impact the numbers, we're not going to do it entirely on our own, Payne.
Are you injured or are you hurt?
When injuries occur in the NFL, there's only one man to turn to.
If you're hurt, you can still play. If you're injured, you can't.
Let's check in with 17-year NFL team doctor turned medical analyst, Dr. David Chow.
So are you hurt or are you injured?
This is Chow's Corner.
He joined us each and every Monday throughout the 2018 NFL season. He'll be back with us every Monday morning to kind of tie up some of the loose ends as it pertains to injury information. You can follow Dr. David Chow on Twitter, at ProFootballDoc. He, of course, was a former NFL head team doctor for 17-plus years, a practicing orthopedic surgeon, and a man who misses absolutely nothing on NFL Sundays. Dr. Chow, it's good to have you back in the Bet the Board fold this season.
Thanks for having me.
So week one, of course, it wouldn't be a week in the National Football League without a couple marquee injuries. I know there's plenty that we're going to get to, but let's start with maybe one of the most impactful as far as a skill position player, especially from a fantasy standpoint. Tyreek Hill hospitalized with a shoulder injury. They claim it's a sternoclavicular joint injury. Don't ask me what that is. I have absolutely no clue that he saw an orthotrauma specialist. Can you kind of contextualize what that may mean to his outlook in the next couple of weeks?
Well, it actually did not make any sense to me when he was reported with a shoulder injury and sent to the hospital. I mean, in my almost 2 decades, we rarely sent people to the hospital and never for a shoulder injury. So it just didn't make any sense. But once it was clarified as a sternoclavicular joint injury, the SC joint, it's the opposite end of the clavicle of the shoulder. It's really a chest injury. So the clavicle, there's the AC joint near the shoulder, acromioclavicular. And basically, this is the side where the collarbone meets the breastbone, for lack of a better word. And it was dislocated in the back posteriorly. And when that happens, there is risk to the great vessels that are right behind there. And so that's why he was sent to the hospital. And he did not have surgery per se, but he did have a procedure to reduce the dislocated joint. And that's why he was not going to fly home with the team and did not, and stayed overnight. And that's why he's going to be out a little bit.
Dr. Chow, what do you think the timeline is on that? I've heard people say 4 weeks on Hill. Some people say 8 weeks. What do you think that looks like for a timeline?
Well, he's got no chance of playing in December. It would be okay. Great if he would play in October. But quite honestly, injured reserve is not out of the question, 8 games and then come back. So they'll have to see. You cannot compare this one to some of the other SC joint injuries. Name another one that required a procedure at the hospital and an overnight stay. from Danny Amendola to others. And Jake Kummerow last year with the Packers missed 8 weeks with an SC joint injury. So look, if I were the Chiefs or I was a Tyreek Hill fan and or he was on my fantasy team or whatever, if you told me mid to late October, I'd take it.
Perfect. And when we talk about his running mate, Patrick Mahomes, the guy who stirs the drink within the Chiefs offense, had an ankle injury, got rolled up on, obviously gutted it out throughout the game, but he was, you know, limping severely. Any worries there moving forward with Patrick Mahomes?
Yeah, there are some worries there. I mean, Andy Reid said it was an ankle sprain, and it makes it sound like it was a nothing. But, you know, I didn't think Patrick Mahomes could show me anything else after last year's performance. But he did here. I mean, he by video, that was a high ankle sprain, maybe on the milder side, but clearly it hampered him. And let me tell you, yeah, he got it taped and came back in the game. Very hard to tape a high ankle sprain. It doesn't really help you. Basketball-type low ankle sprains, you can tape and get some support. High ankle sprains, he's just getting it out, and he did. Now, of course, he wasn't very mobile when he came back, and you probably saw him get a little more sore and limp a little more at the end. And that trajectory can continue. The key is going to be how sore is he today, tomorrow. Don't be shocked if you see him in a walking boot. Don't be shocked if you see him missing some practice. Now, being who he is he going to miss games? Probably not. But he's not going to be the same guy running around for the next few weeks and maybe for a good part of September.
Interesting. And to your point, balls were starting to float a little high there when he wasn't able to step into it and drive the ball. One more quarterback in that game, Nick Foles, obviously.
Yeah, and one more.
Go ahead.
Not to cut you off, Payne, but one more thing on Patrick Mahomes. He is a guy who likely can work his way through that because of his arm strength, right?
Yeah.
Not stepping through throws and so forth. So he's a special guy. And, you know, a quarterback that has a weaker arm probably wouldn't be able to do it, even if he wanted to. But Patrick Mahomes still can get it done.
Absolutely. Massive arm. Nick Foles, same game, obviously. Huge touchdown pass to Shark there on the sidelines, but it looks like he got absolutely obliterated. They're saying clavicle fracture there. How long do we anticipate the Foles injury lasting?
First of all, I just want to ask you guys, do you agree with me? How is it that there was no penalty on that play? Isn't that this whole thing that we talked about last year, body weight on the quarterback and the whole thing?
He was definitely driven into the ground for sure.
I think trying to figure out NFL officiating, guys, after what we see each week, I mean, you may as well flip a coin in terms of what gets called and what's not going to get called.
I mean, it obviously was a huge point of emphasis last year that hasn't been made one this year, right? I mean, that was kind of textbook right there. And that's why the rule's there, because when you drive a quarterback to the ground with his body weight and then put your body weight on top of it, it doesn't hold up. And you know, I didn't want to portend this, but I did write an article in game saying that looks like a clavicle fracture. And fortunately it came through. So he's going to have surgery, which is a smarter way to do it and the quicker return. He's going to have surgery today. And I think he can be back in 6 weeks, no more than eight. So being that he's their star quarterback, I don't think they expend IR on him because if they can get him back a week or two before eight games, I think it's worth it to sort of carry him. Although his backup did pretty well. It's his non-throwing shoulder, which is good news. And by the way, in 2014, he had a fracture on his collarbone as well.
That'll be interesting to see how Gardner Minshew picks up the slack there. Another quarterback for you, Baker Mayfield. Obviously, he's got a wrist injury. He claims it occurred on the Cam Wake safety sack after the game during the press conference. There was a couple beat writers saying that he was holding it really low, tucked in. He had some bandages on the wrist. He's claiming it's just a bruise. But after that sack, he had three interceptions thereafter. Any worries about Baker Mayfield in the wrist injury to his throwing side?
Yeah, there is some worry. By video, I couldn't tell what it was because it was a mass of bodies on the safeties in terms of the replay. But I think it's more than a wrist injury. I'm as much worried about the base of the thumb as the wrist. If you look at his tape job, that's more than a wrist tape job. It includes the thumb. And yes, you make a good point that he threw three interceptions in the fourth quarter later after the sack. And Baker Mayfield may be right. It may be just a bruise. But boy, anytime you involve the thumb and the base of the thumb, that gets me worried about grip on the football, ability to to spin it and push it downfield. And quite honestly, if you have something with your thumb, it affects your grip and thus your accuracy. So that definitely is something to watch. If this were on his left hand, I'd put no worry on it whatsoever. The fact that it's on his right hand and possibly involves his thumb, this is definitely something to watch. He's going to play, but how well is the question.
Something to monitor for sure. And the last one I want to ask you about before I hand it off to Todd again, Joe Mixon, ankle sprain, came out of the game. Didn't have a great game in general, but what do we expect moving forward with that ankle injury? Is it something that's a high ankle sprain or something he can manage as early as next week against San Francisco?
It does not look like a high ankle sprain by video. He got his foot trapped and it was a low inversion ankle sprain. So I expect it is something that he can manage this next week. But the question is, you know, how well? Just because it's a low ankle sprain doesn't mean it's a nothing. It just means it's not going to be longer term or a bigger deal. So we'll have to see how it goes for him. But he's still possible for next week.
Now, Dr. Chow, a couple of injuries for the Chargers, one that occurred in the game yesterday and one with a significantly longer prognosis for one of their more impactful defensive players. We saw Mike Williams kind of hobble off the field, wasn't out there for any snaps in overtime. What did you see there with one of the Chargers' aspiring big-time wide receiver threats?
You know, he certainly kind of was down for a while and holding his knee, maybe the outside, but by video, not a whole lot. I mean, sometimes you just don't see it, or sometimes maybe that's a good sign that there's not a lot there. He shrugged it off after the game. I'm not seeing anything that's overly concerning right now, so hopefully that holds true. And as far as the Chargers came into this year banged up and arguably more banged up than last year. Last year they came in with Hunter Henry with an ACL and Joey Bosa with the list rank. This year they have Russell Okung, left tackle. They're probably only stalwart on the offensive line, who may not play at all this season, and there's not even an outcome from him from the blood clot in the lung yet. And Derwin James, with the refracture and the bent screw in his foot and the follow-up surgery, I mean, December 1 would be a lucky time frame for him to come back. Add to that, they had a bunch of linebackers still hurt, carryover from last year. Now, Denzel Perryman was activated, but that's why in my injury index, I said the Chargers' run defense was not going to look very good yesterday, and I think Marlon Mack chewed him up for 174 yards.
It's always crazy. I mean, you watch that second half, and clearly the Colts found something, and it was trying to take advantage of the Chargers' interior defense. Dr. Chow, can't thank you enough for all the great perspective. We're looking forward to getting you on every single Monday. We know that, hey, injuries become a big part of the game and a massive part of your business, and people can follow you on Twitter, at ProFootballDoc. Look forward to chatting with you the same time next week.
Thank you. I'd love it for you guys to check out the new website, ProFootballDoc.com, where we put out an injury index. And if you looked at it, you would have saw that the Chargers' run game defense did not stack up very well against the Colts' run game offense. And, you know, they're not perfect. It's just injury information. But this one worked out because of the interior of the defense.
It's always good when a plan comes together, no doubt about it.
Thanks, guys.
Always interesting, Payne, to get Dr. Chow's take. We know Kansas City, we mentioned at the top of the show how impressed we were with Sammy Watkins. So maybe the loss of Tyreek Hill won't completely change what Andy Reid and company want to do. But you guys brought up the Patrick Mahomes ankle issue, whether it's a high ankle sprain, whether he's going to go out there and gut through it. How worried would you be about him having to tweak or change his mechanics if he can't plant on the foot or really stride off of it?
Personally or for Chiefs fans?
Let's go combination of two, because I know you're definitely invested in the Patrick Mahomes legacy.
So, yeah, scary. When I saw that happen, I said, oh, Christ, here we go. But I think Patty's going to be fine. We saw one of the touchdown passes in the second half where it was just like all arm on the out route to the end zone. As Dr. Chow alluded to, this could be an injury that is more impactful on a player that doesn't have a rocket arm, but still, we saw some balls floating a little bit high. So something to monitor for sure when you talk about Tyreek Hill not being there and now Patty playing at less than 100%, not ideal early on in the season, but this, to me, cream rose to the top in the AFC. It looks like the Chiefs and the Patriots are on a collision course for the AFC Championship.
May as well pencil them in right now. It's just a question of what venue they'll be playing the AFC Championship in. Will we go back to Arrowhead? Or will it be at Foxborough, given the fact New England doesn't play a team with a pulse until about week 9 this season? Two games, though, left on the NFL week 1 slate, and want to touch on both of them, obviously. So the Monday night Twin Bill kickoff down in the Big Easy, where it's the Saints, a 6.5-point favorite, total in the game 52.5 against the Houston Texans, Payne. And what goes up must come down. Saints covered 9 straight games at one point last year before dropping their final against the spread. You look at how this team has performed in season openers, and while it's nothing to write home about, they've now lost 5 straight openers with all 5 of those games going over the total. But let's start with the Houston Texans, a very different looking offense as far as the running back position and a retooled offensive line.
Yeah, without question. I think also when you look at the Saints defense, it's going to be a little different in this game. You're without 2 of your better interior linemen. Sheldon Rankins tore his Achilles late last year. He's out. David Onyemata is suspended for the first game. So I'm interested to see what Bill O'Brien does in this game. If he's going to try to establish the run and some balance, I pray to God he does it with Duke Johnson. I am just not a Carlos Hyde guy, right? Stunned he is still in the league. You look at some of his metrics last year, between Cleveland and Jacksonville, Carlos Hyde was successful on roughly 38% of his runs. That's about 10% below league average. So I'm a Duke Johnson guy. It feels like he's kind of been like typecasted and stereotyped as this pass catch back only. But you look, Duke Johnson's actually the all-time leading rusher in Miami Hurricanes history, and he did it in 3 seasons. So when you look at the guys who've run through there with Edgerrin James and Clinton Portis and Willis McGahee, and for the older guys listening, Otis Anderson, 4 great backs. So Duke Johnson's still the all-time leading rusher for the Hurricanes. So I just hope it's not this ground and pound to an inefficient Carlos Hyde all night. Really like what I think we're going to see from this Texans pass game. Obviously, Deshaun Watson, DeAndre Hopkins, Will Fuller, all are set to play in this game. If you look at that sample size when those 3 play, it's pretty impressive. It's why there's a lot of hype on Houston. In that 11-game sample where Watson, Hopkins, and Fuller all played, the Texans averaged 31 points per game. Watson has a 106 passer rating. In the same breath, you look at this, games where Will Fuller has played with Deshaun Watson, he's averaged 1.5 yards more per pass attempt, 1.5 more touchdowns. This is a Saints defense as good as it was stopping the run in overall efficiency. They did allow some big plays. They're 25th in explosive pass defense. So that's something to monitor here with Will Fuller back in the lineup. Can they hit a couple chunk plays? That's the biggest thing. You do have that shutdown corner that we've raved about for years in Marcus Lattimore. But if you look at the teams that have really given the Saints secondary issues, it's teams with these deep receiving cores. And it's not just DeAndre Hopkins here, Will Fuller back. You also have Kenny Stills. He makes a fantastic 3. He's actually better out of the slot. So if Kiki Kuti can't go, Stills, I think, fills in nicely in that slot role. It's a spot that he thrived in with the Dolphins. If Kuti plays, then you have 4 guys that are just, ridiculously talented, catching balls out of the backfield. I think Titus Howard is interesting as well. I know, Bill O'Brien came out, said he's going to be conservative with him. He's got a finger issue, but he's been practicing. So it would be odd to see a guy be a full go at practice and not play here. Him and Tunzel on the left side really solidify things in a big way for this Texans offense.
When we look at the Houston Texans, we talked at great lengths on the podcast preview, which, as you mentioned earlier in the show, still available if there's any teams you want to do a little bit more of a deep dive on. How they struggled in pass protection. Of course, Deshaun Watson has to own some of that, looking to try and scramble and extend plays rather than throwing a football away. They allowed a sack rate of over 10.5%, 60-plus sacks, the most for any team in the league. When we look at the Saints defensively, Marcus Davenport, all the expectations are that he's starting to turn into what can be an elite pass rusher opposite Cam Jordan. But you mentioned Lattimore, had a bit of a sophomore slump last season, has said he rededicated himself, whether he got big, fat, and happy or whatever it was, that he wants to try and show that rookie season wasn't mirage. That's more of what you're going to see here. Where do you think the Texans need to go about? You mentioned explosive pass plays. Do you think they can be balanced enough, or do you just kind of throw caution to the wind? Hey, look, we're going to air it out. We have a healthy receiving core, and that's where we're going to be able to do our damage.
I think it's got to be about balance, right? It's just got to be with the right guys. So I mentioned the interior linemen being out for the Saints, that's a big blow. Let's get Duke Johnson running the ball a little bit between the tackles if you're going to choose to run that way. You mentioned some of the pressure that the Saints have been able to create on the outside, Davenport looking to take that year two leap. And from the Texans' standpoint, right, I get that Watson likes to scramble around, but the bottom line is he was pressured on a league-high 45% of his dropbacks, 281 total pressures last year. So it's on this offensive line that's been upgraded. You bring in Laremy Tunzel. I think he is a massive addition day one. If Titus plays, it's a good left guard situation. You have Max Sharping at coming in from NIU, coming back to Texas. He's a Texas boy playing at right guard. So I think the offensive line is going to be really improved. Obviously, Chantrell Henderson at right tackle is a liability in pass protection, but at least you can see it coming if you're Deshaun Watson. So I like the offense for Houston this year if Bill O'Brien operates it in the right manner.
Other side of the ball, we know that the Saints, Alvin Kamara, will be the featured weapon. Michael Thomas gets his massive payday. We talked at great lengths about Drew Brees and whether it was regression because of age or he was dealing with an injury over the latter half of the season. Texans come into this contest, no Jadeveon Clowney, putting a little bit more pressure on the likes of J.J. Watt. And we're going to need to see Whitney Mercilus try and up his game, returning more to that 2016-ish form than what we saw a season ago. What are some of the matchups you're watching for the Saints offense matched up against the Texans defense?
It'll be really interesting. You kind of mentioned Clowney there, right? Let's see what this Texans defensive line looks without him. And I know a lot of people said, hey, he's not the pass rusher we thought he could be when we drafted him out of South Carolina. And certainly he's worked on that a little bit. But Jadeveon Clowney was one of the best run-setting edges in the entire NFL. And when you look at Houston, they were number one last year in adjusted line yards. They were third in stuff rate. They didn't let a lot of guys get to the second level and rip off these massive runs. So they were one of the very best run-stopping defenses. So it's going to be interesting because there's a lot of people saying, oh, you know, Drew Brees, the arm thing. We've touched on that in a great deal. I think Drew Brees is fine. We've kind of identified where that injury took place, the off-season regimen that he's implemented to strengthen that shoulder. So it'll be interesting to see how the offense operates tonight. But I do think this is what I'm hearing is they're probably going to move Michael Thomas around a little bit more this season. If you look last year, they did a good job kind of camoing him. You think this big bulky receiver, he's going to end up outside on smaller corners. No, they flexed him into the slot a lot. Over 30% of his snaps came from the slot last season. It's a spot that you can really take advantage of. That's where Drew Brees likes to throw the ball now at this point. But the biggest thing here is let's see if they can establish the ground game now that Jadeveon Clowney's out. We've talked, I think, a little bit last year about this Houston defense, right? We kind of banged the table, said, hey, you know, good stop in the run, but they're a little bit fraudulent. You look at that overall number last year, finished seventh in defensive efficiency, but it came against the second easiest schedule of offenses. This certainly one of those offenses that's going to present a tall task, a tall challenge here, I think, for the Texans defense. Let's see. This is a good gauge for that unit.
Last thing on this game, the number pain. We've seen it come off of the key from 7 down to 6.5 consensus. Suffice to say that there's a little bit of appetite from professional bettors on the dog at a full touchdown.
That was the number, yeah. Yeah. So I'm not currently in love with it, but I get, you know, the aspect of why it's come off the 7. Certainly a sharp side. I've also seen some under money come in. Not totally sure how that's correlated, but there is some sharp money at under 53.5, 53, and 52.5. But in terms of the side, yes, at 7, the Texans were by. Obviously, Saints, big game on deck next week, I hear.
Yeah, just for anyone that hasn't looked at the schedule, would encourage you to do so. Maybe one that Saints fans have had circled for a few months, to say the least. From the early game to the night game as we head out to the black hole, where it's the Oakland Raiders, now a 2.5-point home underdog against the Denver Broncos. Total in this game, 42.5 pain. During the summer, the Raiders originally opened in this contest as a 3-point favorite. We're obviously clearly trending towards 3 the other way with a ton of public support for the road favorite. First thing that I want to ask you, I mean, what did Antonio Brown's absence mean to the number? And then we'll get into what his impact will be or lack thereof on the field.
What'd you make of the Pittsburgh offense last night?
I'd say that it looked pretty pedestrian at best, and Juju Smith-Schuster is going to have his hands full as a number one wide receiver in this league.
So, regardless of the off-field stuff and the antics, and it certainly is somewhat annoying and familiar with the situation, obviously, with Antonio living down here in Miami and his agent being Drew Rosenhaus, he's got to get it figured out mentally. That said, there are a lot of guys in this league that have done significantly worse things that don't seem to be catching the heat that Antonio Brown has. He is still dynamic, can take the lid off of defense, great route runner. When his mindset is there, he is one of the hardest workers. I think you're looking at, and if we just look, and it's probably a bad test, right? Because New England's defense is just so disciplined. They had an entire offseason to game plan against a guy like Mike Tomlin, but I think you're looking at AB when all things are go, at least a point or to the spread in my mind.
Yeah, I mean, clearly Oakland is going to see a massive drop off now from Antonio Brown being a bona fide number one to Tyrell Williams having to take that mantra alongside J.J. Nelson. Not exactly a who's who at the wide receiver position. When you look at the way this series has gone, Denver and Oakland have split the season series each of the last 4 years with the home team winning every matchup over the last three seasons. And what I found a little bit unique, and then of course we'll get into the game itself, this is the first time Denver will open the season on the road since 2010, and it's only the 13th time that they've opened the season on the road since 1978. Scheduling anomaly, call it what you will, I found that a little bit odd to say the least.
And not great if you're a Denver fan, because we know those early home season games at elevation seem to have quite the impact on the outcomes of those games, especially with the new CBA. And you can't train as well. Teams aren't in as great a shape early on in the season. So not having that opening game at elevation definitely hinders Denver a little bit.
Well, you know what will hinder the Raiders tonight? Questions on your offensive line, I would think, Payne. But they paid Trent Brown. We talked about that, and everyone's curious to see what he looks like. No Richie Incognito suspended. They lose Gabe Jackson. How important is a guy like Colton Miller to try and at least fortify this offensive line and make sure that David Carr has some time under center, or Derek Carr has some time under center? Yeah,
David Carr actually was really pissed at all the reports that were coming out that said AB and Derek Carr didn't have a great relationship. He was like clamoring and chiming in and just making his voice feel felt on Twitter the other day. It was really interesting. Obviously, Colton's huge when you talk about three guys on that offensive line not being there. And the thing that you look at without AB now, what does it look like for this passing games in terms of explosiveness? We know Derek Carr has never averaged more than 12.5% of his throws deep down the field. That was supposed to change this season. That was supposed to be a different element that AB brought to this offense. Because if you look, you're going to try to establish the ground game with two or three guys potentially out of that offensive line. You're going up against a Broncos defense that was top 10 in rushing success rate defense. Now, some of those numbers a little bit skewed, right? If you dig a little bit deeper into some of those metrics, Broncos did finish 23rd in adjusted line yards, 30th in stuff rate. So it's got to be vital that Josh Jacobs and the interior linemen and the rest of the O-linemen that are filling in this game are able to establish the ground game. Because right now at this point, Derek Carr hasn't proven that he can carry an offense. I do like Gruden in general, though, as an offensive mind. And we kind of hit on this on the AFC preview podcast. The offense last season was actually very good despite only winning four games. It was quite the anomaly there that they were able to finish top 15 in both rushing and passing success rate despite only winning four games. So from a mindset standpoint, there's not a guy right now that's spending more time in the film room devising things than John Gruden. The question becomes, are the other things within the realm of football is he capable of doing? And those questions are yet to be answered. Like, don't touch the roster. Just focus on the offense. Tough task tonight, though, obviously going against a Broncos defense that I think with Vic Fangio gets back to being an elite unit.
When we look at the other side of the ball and try and figure out how Denver's new-look offense led by Joe Flacco will match up against the Oakland defense, what are some of the things you're going to be looking for in Flacco's debut?
Key matchup here is the interior, I think, of the Raiders defense, right? You have Maurice Hurst, you have Jonathan Hankins. They need to be disruptors. That's bottom line. They need to stop the run. They need to actually create some pressure and get to Flacco, I think, a little bit from the inside. Absolutely love Mike Munchak. Great O-line coach, came over from Pittsburgh. He's going to help that Broncos O-line a little bit, but I think there's just so many question marks with the interior line of the Broncos. You lose Matt Paradis, the all-world center, in free agency. Then Ronald Leary, he's going to play, obviously, but he's kind of working his way back from an Achilles injury. So that Broncos interior, it has to be better than we project, I think. You look at a statue-like quarterback with Joe Flacco. He's been ridiculously poor when you can flush him from the pocket, force him to make plays outside and on the move a little bit. Graded out the fourth worst quarterback outside the pocket the last three seasons. So when you look at his passer rating, it's somewhat similar to Goff when you look at him being pressured. 45-point dip when under pressure for Flacco versus when he can operate from a clean pocket. There's also an interesting game within the game here, okay? And I think our listeners may probably know now, if they've watched Hard Knocks, Paul Gunther, the Oakland defensive coordinator, kind of got some shine there, I think, in the last episode, and Gruden was praising him. He's like, oh, you know, Gunther's going to be a head coach pretty soon in this league. Gunther was actually the Cincinnati Bengals defensive coordinator from 2014 through 2017. So it's like four seasons worth of data, a lot of familiarity there. Flacco kind of came out this week, said, hey, we know what Gunther likes to do. We know he likes to send heat in critical situations. That all said, there was like a seven-game sample size where Flacco faced Gunther-led defenses, completed just 59% of his passes, threw for about 232 on average, but he actually had more picks than touchdowns. So that's going to be interesting. Flacco claims that he's going to be very familiar with the defense he's seeing. It's going to help. It's going to be advantageous to this Broncos offense. Let's see if that comes to fruition, because he hasn't been great against the Paul Gunther-led defenses. But again, the key to this matchup is, can the interior of the Broncos O-line create some spaces in the ground game? Can they keep Flacco upright? Because if pressure's coming from the inside, which is where I think Gunther's going to send a lot of these blitzes, and Flacco's flush from the pocket, this game could be a little bit more interesting than I think people anticipate.
I know money has been hard to find, but I mean, I have to imagine you're going to see a little bit of support from the Raiders in the betting market if this gets to a full field goal, no?
At three, for sure. But I don't know if we get there. That'll be interesting to see. Now, at plus money in the summer, and let's kind of differentiate this, at plus 2.5, at plus 2, at plus 1, there was significant sharp money on the Denver Broncos. And then we saw this kind of level out at a pick. Then you had the initial AB reports about him not playing. This number shot to Denver minus 2, 2.5 at that point. So it was sophisticated bettors kind of getting out ahead slash bookmakers adjusting their number on the news. And then once it came back to the point where, hey, AB's probably going to plan to play, we saw this number shoot back to pick. Now that he's off the team, obviously, and in New England, we're back out to 2.5. This is going to be really interesting. I'm not sure where we go from here, but to your point, I think if we get to 3, could see a little buyback. I know there are some 3s out there in some of the new areas over in Jersey, but it'll be interesting to see if it gets there at some of the sharper shops. I know we're looking at like 2.7 right now in the market.
I mean, you hate to speculate on what this game means to the Raiders, given everything that's gone on with Antonio Brown, but you quickly glance at their schedule. They don't win today. I mean, these wins are already going to be hard to come by for a team who's over-under projected at 5.5. I can't imagine the season outlook gets a little rosier if you get a loss handed to you by one of your most hated division rivals in the Denver Broncos.
No, absolutely not. It's why this win total opened 6. We're now down to 5.5. Obviously, AB not there is a huge part, but not just the schedule in terms of his difficulty, right? But look at all the travel. And we know Gruden has openly admitted, like, man, I hate the travel. This thing stinks. I hate hopping on a plane. Like 32,000 miles they will travel this season. It's absolutely ridiculous. I was reading it the other day. The Bills, Giants, and Jets combined don't travel that much. So those three teams travel combined versus the Raiders. The Raiders travel 30% more than those three teams together. It's nuts. So this is it. This feels like, as you alluded to, a must-win territory here for Oakland. Not a game I am on, though, at this point.
Yeah, I mean, when you look at this game, I mean, you mentioned it. They'll play at home again next week against the Kansas City Chiefs, so they'll be more than a touchdown underdog, and then Oakland won't return for a true home game until early in November. So clearly the deck not exactly lining up the way that Raiders faithful would have liked it, given all the off-field saga and never seeing Antonio Brown play a meaningful down for the Silver and Black. But two great games nonetheless. We always appreciate the fact that the NFL throws us a little bit of a bone on Monday Night Football so we get a Twin Bill doubleheader. Payne, the biggest question I have for you, will you make it through the Broncos and Raiders game in its entirety, or do we feel there's going to be bedtime right around halftime of this one?
Yeah, that's the more efficient play, right? Now that you have Game Pass and a slew of other things where you can watch a full game in about 30 minutes, I'm going to be getting some sleep this year. Going to be sleeping a lot better. That's the goal.
All right, well, let's see if you can adhere to that. I mean, the jury's still out. We're only one weekend, and want to make sure that schedule stays intact. Any other things, parting shots, words of advice before we take about a 48-hour break? We reconvene on Wednesday and talk a little college football.
Oh, there is a Wednesday podcast. I was looking at the schedule. I didn't know college football actually had a schedule this week. Man, is that brutal.
We were debating. I mean, maybe we'll just go like a quickly abbreviated, hey, we're going to preview Iowa, Iowa State. We'll hit on like two or three other games for about a minute and a half to 2 minutes. And then you can talk about hygiene habits and go through organic soap and loofah discussion. We can talk nutrition, about what kind of smoothies you prefer, the Lara Bar preferences, and otherwise, you know, life advice that we typically shy away from here on this fine podcast.
Yeah, there was a guy who said he didn't like the apple pie Lara Bar. I mean, what are you doing? What are you doing? Blasphemy. I obviously like the peanut butter chocolate better, but in terms of like the healthiness of it, I think the apple pie and the blueberry are better for you.
Yeah, you got to stay balanced on the nutritional value with you know, all those things that come along with it. But either way, successful weekend for as far as Bet the Board podcast listeners were concerned. Got to the window with Coastal Carolina outright in the college ranks. Buffalo, a little bit of a sweatbox. But always fun when you can cash a 3-point underdog with a 1-point victory. So for Dr. David Chow, who will be with us on Mondays going forward, for Payne Insider, I am Todd Furman. Best of luck with all of your investments on Monday Night Football. Should it be one game? Should it be both games? Should it be none? Hopefully we'll see you at the window.